We're going to move to session 8 on magnetic fields in supernova remnants and pulsar with nebulae, starting with an invited talk by Barbara Olney, who's going to tell us about modeling pulsar with nebulae and their magnetic fields.
Thank you, Samar. So, okay, can you hear me? Yes. First of all, I would like to thank the organizer for inviting me to give this talk. And this is obviously only a very small summary of an argument which is very, very huge. So I have tried to sum up the things that I think are the most important in order to model within an MHD description pulsar wind nebulae. So as you all know, PWN are characterized by a field center morphology, and they also show very extended, very broadband spectrum, non-thermal spectrum. And the primary mechanism is synchrotron radiation, which is emitted by relativistic particles interacting with the intense magnetic field of the nebula. We have already seen this basic picture. We have some problems with the slides. There is some overlapping of two different slides, so this is not a problem for this. So we have already seen this basic picture this morning, which describes the standard picture for a young pulsar wind nebula, in which we have that the central star is the engine of the system, and it fills the entire remnant with a plasma which is made by particles and magnetic field. This is the pulsar wind, which is a cold, magnetized, and relativistic wind. The fact that it is cold means that we cannot have any information, any direct information, from the emission that comes from this region. The interaction of this wind with the supernova remnant material induces the formation of a strong termination shock. And the emission that we actually observe comes from the shocked part of the plasma. So this is the synchrotron bubble that we observe. So the first attempt to model PWN, of course, comes with 1D and 2D static models, which are based on assumption in order to simplify the problem, the description of the problem. And they have mainly these three parameters in their model, in which we have the particle spectral index in order to reproduce the spectrum, the Lorentz factor of the pulsar wind, and its magnetization. The magnetization is given by this expression, and it is more or less directly proportional to the most important parameter is the magnetic field of the wind. So despite their very simplified assumption and the fact that they are only 1D, they can account for some of the observed properties of these systems. So they can account for example, for the position of the termination shock in the Crab Nebula, which is the boundary of the underluminous area that we observed in the X-ray images, for example. They can account for the formation of the optical and X-ray spectrum as due to synchrotron radiation. And they also can account for the decreasing of the nebula size with the increasing of energy, which is another sign of the synchrotron emission. The other important thing is that they can, they allow us for obtaining some values for these important parameters connected to the pulsar physics. So what we expect for the high energy particles, the emitting particles, is that the magnetic field, the wind Lorentz factor is of order of 10 to the sixth. While for magnetization, what we can obtain is that we expect a value of order of 10 to the minus 3, which is quite low. And this is the base of the so-called sigma paradox. Why sigma paradox? Because from pulsar theories, we expect to have a very high value of the magnetization at the location of the light cylinder of the pulsar. So we can expect here to have a magnetization of order of 10 to the fourth. But 1D models, or the radiative models, tell us that magnetization and determination shock should be more or less a 7 order of magnitude lower. So it is really a very huge difference. And even if the way between the light cylinder of the pulsar and the termination shock is very long, it is very difficult to account for such dissipation of magnetic field with standard mechanisms. The second problem of these simplified models is, is the fact that the situation is much more complex than what appears in the first observation. So as soon as we get information from Chandra about the inner structure of this nebula, we see that we observe a very beautiful complex structure in the inner nebula, in which you observe an equatorial torus, which is developed in the equatorial plane of the pulsar, and the formation of two polar jets that appear to originate very near to the pulsar itself. And we also can see the presence of a large variety of bright features, which are more or less which bore more or less near to the termination shock location. For example, we observe these variable knots in the Crab Nebula, the presence of arcs, and other knots in the Vela Nebula. And we have these wisps, which are these bright arcs that form near to the shock location and move outwards and are seen at different wavelengths. So the situation is much more complex than we can describe with 1D models. The first problem is to explain how these polar jets forms. So the point is that they appear to originate very near to the pulsar, so much nearer than the estimated size of the termination shock itself. But the problem is that we know that magnetic collimation in the relativistic plasma is not an efficient mechanism. So the way out is that, it is obvious that this collimation must occur outside the termination shock in the shocked plasma, which is not so much relativistic. And the solution comes from this work, these two works, maybe, the first one that discussed this problem. And they say that if you account that the energy flux in the pulsar wind is not isotropically distributed, you can describe this formation of jets. And why this? Because if you assume that the mass of the energy is concentrated in the equatorial axis of the pulsar, what you get is that now the termination shock is no more spherical, but you get a shape which is oblate. And you have an equatorial extension which is much larger than the polar one. And this is the reason why the jets appear to originate so close to the pulsar. And after that point, you can see that the plasma is diverted toward the polar axis, and obsesses are efficient in order to collimate the jets. So 2D MHD models of pulsar wind nebulae have to account all these things. So we have to consider that the energy flux in the wind is anisotropic in order to reproduce the formation of this oblate shape of the shock. And the other thing is that we have to account for the geometry of the field. And the thing is that we expect to have a very high level of dissipation of the magnetic field between the light cylinder of the pulsar of the nebula of the pulsar to the pulsar wind nebula termination shock. And the way to describe this is that we also heard this during this morning talks, but we have a formation of the so-called striped wind model. So we have that due to the inclination between the pulsar wind rotational axis and the magnetic field axis, we get this very complex structure of the field in which we have alternating stripes of different polarities, which are separated by an oscillating current sheet, which has a very complex structure. And it is a very good place in order to account for dissipation. The first 2D MHD models, numerical models, I mean, are very successful in order to account for the formation of the oblate shape of the shock. So what we get is that the shape of the shock is oblate due to the anisotropy of the wind, and also they account for the formation of the polar jets, but they put a lower limit on the magnetization. And what we get is that we increase by at least one order of magnitude the estimation from 1D models. The other thing that is well reproduced by these 2D models is the variability of the inner nebula. So what in many different work, it was found that it is possible to account for the formation of the wisp in the Crab Nebula and to account for the formation at the different energy and also their outward velocities in the nebula. And from this kind of studies of the wisp properties, it is also possible to investigate in some way the acceleration mechanism at work at the termination shock in Crab. Since from observation, we know that wisps arise at different locations, and they have also different velocities, outward velocities, at the different energy bands. For example, radio wisps and optical and X-ray wisps are not coincident. In order to account for these results within an MHD description, what we have to do is to account for acceleration of particles responsible for emission at the different energies at different sectors of the shock. Why this? Because if you inject particles around the entire surface of the shock, what you get is that the, well, in these plots you have the maximum emission in each arc of each wisp during time. So each point represents the maximum along the arc during time. And what you get if you inject particles uniformly at the shock is that the wisps are completely coincident at a different wavelength. So in order to account for the difference that we observe, we have to inject particles at different locations. And that also means, since the physical conditions of the wind are very different from point to point along the shock, since the shock is oblate, what you get is that you can account for different acceleration mechanisms for the different particle emitting at different energies. But 2D models have also very strong limitations. The most important one is that they cannot account for the correct reproduction of the geometry of the magnetic field. Why this? Because the approximation of two dimensions artificially compresses the magnetic field around the polar axis. So what you get is that the magnetic pressure is completely concentrated around the axis. And this means two things mainly. The fact that you are not mixing your field. The field is not transported in the bulk of the nebula. So everything you are injecting here is diverted along the axis, and it doesn't reach the nebula itself. And this means that you cannot increase the initial value of the magnetization because you are not dissipating enough. So the final result is that you get a field that could be the one that you expect around the polar axis. But if you average the field in the bulk of the nebula, what you get is that the average field is well lower than the one that you expect. And this has very strong consequences when you try to reproduce emission. For example, if you consider the emission in the radio band from simulation of the Crab Nebula in 2D, and you try to compare with the radio observation, and you expect to have something which is more or less uniform along the nebula, what you get is that your emission map is more or less shaped in the same way of the magnetic field. So you get the most of the emission is concentrated around the polar axis where the field is higher. And this also affects very much the spectrum at the highest energy. Since the field is low, you get very low radiation losses. And that means that the high energy particles must be, you have to introduce an artificial steepening in the spectral index of the high energy particles just to try to fit the spectrum. And these also have an important consequences for the reproduction of the inverse Compton part of the spectrum. Since your magnetic field is underestimated, the inverse Compton emission is overestimated. And you can fit the data only if you correct the average value of the field to the equipartition one. So which is the solution is moving to 3D, because these systems are 3D in the reality. And the fact is that if you consider 3D simulation, you can get a very complex structure of the field, which is now no more concentrated in a part of your nebula, but it is now well distributed around the nebula itself. One important thing is that in 3D, you get a very efficient kink instability, which allows for a very high level of dissipation of the magnetic field. So the first thing is that you can reach values of the magnetization which are greater than the unity. You can reach 10 or probably also more. And that means that this is the possible solution to the sigma paradox. The fact that the field is more complicated is also given by, if you look, it is impossible to read this, but this is a 2D cut along this plane, in which you get the ratio between the toroidal and colloidal component of the field, where toroidal is, say, orange, and blue is colloidal. So even if you are injecting something which is completely toroidal when at initialization, what you get is due to the efficient mixing of the field, you suddenly, you finish up with something which has a very strong poloidal component. So if you move outwards from the inner structure, the inner nebula when you expect to have the torus, you find that the poloidal component is dominant in the most of the places. The bad news is that 3D simulations are very, very demanding in terms of numerical resources and also in terms of physical time. So just to give you an example, in order to run this simulation here, which is the longest one for the case of the Crab Nebula, I spent more than 1 million of GPU hours and more or less six months of my life. So they are very, very demanding. And moreover, they are not the real, well, they are not the complete solution because we can account for the geometry of the field, but they also show a very high level of dissipation, which we are not sure that it is the natural one. Because if you see here, this is the plot of the average field in microgauss versus time. So the first simulation, 3D simulation is the one by Port et al, and they stop their simulation due to the numerical resources that they get at 70 years of evolution. And what they found that the magnetic, the average field is more or less the one that we expect, a factor of two lower probably. But in our cases, in our case in which we have reached the self-similar expansion phase and the simulation is well longer than the first one, what we get is that the field is keep decreasing during time unless it, and finally it, it find a constant value, let's say, which is well lower than the expected value because in Crab the expected value is between 200 and 300 micrograms. So we finally have more or less the same problem in reproducing the spectrum. The, well, one important and maybe surprising thing is that we, when we compare 3D and 2D results, what we get is that, of course, the global dynamics is completely different. But if you look at the inner nebula, the inner dynamics, the situation is not so much different. So the dynamics is more or less the correct one. That means that we can, well, safely say that the results for 2D MHD models in the inner nebula are still valid. So how does this change if we consider evolved systems? So at the beginning, I say that the basic picture for young system was the one that I show. And with evolved one, I mean more, well, the one in which we have, we expect the pulsar to leave the system, so only the one that form bow shocks. So you probably know that a very large fraction of all the pulsar is born with a high kick velocity. And that means that these stars are fated to escape from their supernova remnant shell on timescales which are shorter if compared with their typical ages. And that means that from a certain point, the pulsar starts to interact directly with the interstellar medium. But since the sound speed in the interstellar medium is in general well lower than the pulsar's velocity, its motion is supersonic. And that means that a bow shock separates the nebula from the outer medium, and this reshapes completely the initial, the initial shape of the nebula itself. So what you get is that the bow shock has, the nebula has the shape of the bow of the external bow shock, and also the termination shock is expected to be completely different from the previous cases. And these systems, bow shock nebula, are in fact seen as cometary-like system in which you have a very bright head, which is around the pulsar location, which is followed by a very elongated tail. And this system also show very puzzling features. So, for example, we get some very surprising misaligned jet with respect to the directional motion. So the system is moving in this way, and we have this very powerful jet in the opposite direction. And also, it was revealed not so much time ago, a very extended TV halo around Geminga. And that means these two things point to the fact that probably we have a very efficient particle escape from these systems, and also that the particles that are able to escape are also efficiently distributed around, around the remnant. The first models to account for this geometry are, of course, again, 2D MHD models. And the main results from this model is that they can account for the formation of the bow shock due to the velocity of the pulsar, of the pulsar in the surrounding medium. And they also account for the formation of this reshaped termination shock. But they can only reproduce a very small part of the tail. And the 2D approximation leads the tail to be completely cylindrical. So even if you extend this grid in this direction, you will get something which is which has exactly the same shape of the inner part of the tail. So again, you have to, to go 3D to represent these systems. And well, the way to model the wind and its magnetic field are more or less the same that I discussed before. With well, you have also another very important parameter here, which is the inclination angle between the pulsar speed and the pulsar spin axis. And you can consider these very three representative cases. So you are aligned, you are counter-aligned, or the things are in the middle. So the first results from this kind of simulation show that, as probably expected, the geometry of the magnetic field has a very strong influence on the shape of the head and also on the shape of the termination shock, which is very different from case to case. And surprisingly, in the case of bow shock nebulae, the eventual anisotropy of the outer medium only slightly affects the shape of the forward shock, so the shape of the outer part of the bow shock. But the geometry of the field and its characteristics also are very important in order to describe the dynamics inside the tail itself. So here you can see the maps of magnetic field for different geometries, different values of the magnetization, and different inclination angles between the spin axis of the pulsar and its velocity. And as I said before, the different geometries, so different inclinations, mainly reshape the contact discontinuity, so the outer part of the bow shock itself. But when you change magnetization and isotropy, or you decide if your wind is isotropic distributed or not, what you get is that the inner dynamics of the tail is very different from case to case. For example, if we consider the same model for the wind, so we are in the azeotropic case, and we compare two different levels of magnetization, so we have here the low magnetized case and here the high magnetized one, what we get is the level of turbulence inside the tail is very, very different. It's very different. So when the magnetization is very low, you have a very high level of turbulence, and also the flow inside the tail is more or less chaotic. When magnetization is high, the level of turbulence is very low, and what you get is that the flow is almost laminar. Very far from the pulsar, it remains more or less laminar. And there is also a big difference when you consider the same value of the magnetization. This is the case sigma equal to 1, but you compare the isotropic model with the anisotropic one. So in all cases, the anisotropic one is the one in which you have the higher level of turbulence developed. And this is more clear if you consider a planar cut along the tail, which is not in this position, but it is in the very far part of the tail. And we look at one of the components of the magnetic field. What we get is that in the isotropic case, we can still recognize the different polarities of the field in the very far part of the tail. While in the case of the anisotropic wind, what we get is everything is more or less mixed up. So it is difficult to distinguish which are the initial condition of the wind that we injected. We have done this game of comparing things for all the models that we have considered in this work. And what we get is that the highest level of turbulence is developed by the anisotropic model with the lowest magnetization. But as soon as you move down to the isotropic model and increase the magnetization, what you get is that the level of turbulence starts to decrease, And finally, you get the flow inside within the tail is more or less completely laminar. And the development of turbulence has also very important consequences for the emission properties. So if we compare here the case with the highest level of turbulence and the case with the lowest level of turbulence, what we get is that in the case of the high level of turbulence, we have a very uniform emissivity from the bow shock. And on the contrary, the polarization is more or less, well, we have no polarization. So the system is completely unpolarized. So the polarization level is very low. And if you could see here, the polarization vector is completely randomic. On the contrary, if you consider the case with the lowest level of turbulence, what you get is that now emission is completely dominated by the head. So you have a spot of emission here, and the tail is more or less underluminous. But you have also a very strong polarization. So the level of polarization is very high along the entire bow shock. And also you have that the polarization vector is completely aligned with the main direction of the field in the tail. So this is the very last argument that I want to discuss a bit. So the thing is that we saw that from this system, we have evidence of escaping of particles. So the idea is that in order to account for this escaping effect, you have to introduce the magnetic field of the outer medium. So what we do is to include the magnetic field of the interstellar medium. And in this case, we have decided to put it in the orthogonal direction with respect to the pulsar velocity, and then inject particles into the wind. What we find is that the particles in the polar cone of the wind are confined by the current sheet to stream along the magnetopause layer. And this is true until they find their connection point between the magnetic field inside the nebula and the outer magnetic field. So from this point, what we found is that you have a very efficient particle losses, particle escaping, sorry. And they form very elongated jets which are completely misaligned with respect to the pulsar direction of motion, but they are aligned to the outer magnetic field direction. And these are more or less similar to what we expect, to what we observe in some systems. So my conclusion are, well, the take-home message of this brief summary is that if you want to reproduce correctly the magnetic field of a pulsar wind nebula, you have to go 3D. And 2D simulation can only, with magnetic field, of course, can only be applied if you want to investigate the very inner structure of the nebula. And if you want to reproduce a large amount of emission properties from these systems, since you cannot go 3D to investigate a very large amount of systems, what you can do is, well, what you can safely do, probably better than using a 2D MHD approach, is to use a 2D HD approach, in which the magnetic field is simply traced as a numerical part, as a numerical tracer. It is not attached to the dynamics, because otherwise what you get is that the magnetic field is completely distorted, and so you also get something in emission which is completely not realistic. So this is, in this case, what you get is more or less more similar to the reality, since you are not not destroying the structure of the field. You are simply saying that the field is more or less uniform into the nebula. So that's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Questions?
Yeah. I just want a clarification. So when you said that the most of the emission is coming from the head of the bow shock,
yeah,
you mean the bolometric luminosity, right? Because if you look at lower wavelengths, at some point you become completely thick, and then you only care about the area, right? So at low enough frequency, you always be dominated by the.
Well, this is radio emission.
Yes, but even in radio emission, if you go to low enough frequency, you'd become completely thick, and it also depends on the density. So I just want to.
Well, the thing is that it depends mostly on the magnetic field there. So this part is not due to the fact that you have more density there. You have more pressure, because you have the field which is completely compressed around the head. But this is the reason why you get so much emission from that point.
I
I'm just commenting, you have to have 3D because you have no dynamo, only in three dimensions.
If I, magnetic. If we consider, sorry, I can't.
You have dynamo only in three dimensions, you must have 3D.
So if we have considered a dynamo effect inside here, no. It is still enough complicated.
Right behind,
I don't understand. So the first part of the paper, you compare the magnetic field evolution for both results and your result. Why the magnetic field strengths increase with time?
Or I'm sorry, why the multiple wisps?
Magnetic field strength increase with time.
Or why increase with
after
time?
After 100 years ago.
From, well, you mean this? Here or in the case of the Crab Nebula?
First part of your talk.
It's the beginning. You mean?
Yeah.
Why it increased here?
Yeah.
Well, we are not sure. Probably the thing is that you more or less find a stable condition. So you have something which is dissipating a lot. Yeah. And when you reach this part, you are finding in some way stability. So you have, you are starting to not dissipate that much the field. So in some way you are adding new field and it is not completely dissipated. So you get a first part in which you are increasing the average field and then you get this stable condition.
Okay, but this value is, you mean the equipartition value or something like that? Or
I'm sorry.
But the Parseval Nebula is still expanding in this stage. So magnetic field strength must be decreased with time. Why?
Because you expected it is still decreasing all the time. Ah. This is the question. Well, the fact is that here you reach more or less the self-similar evolution. So this system is not initialized at time equals zero. So time equals zero is the simulation time. In the initial parameters are for a system which have more or less 250 years. So what you get is that here you are finding the self-expansion phase of the system. So what you get is that you are reaching the equipartition field. And this is the reason why this position which is constant in time.
Any other? Yeah, in the back.
Thank you for your talk. It was terrific. I have a question going back to Delzana and the gang back in 2004 and 2007. The argument has always been that radiative cooling really only accounts for about 10% or less of the energy budget, and therefore there's no need to couple radiative cooling to the flow dynamics. But I just wondered, have you tested that? Have you ever just tried to do it to see if that argument holds up?
Well, that's difficult because the thing is that we have investigated radio emission with 2D models. So the problem is that, as you saw, it is impossible to account for the complete dynamics of the system. So we know that the dynamics is wrong in the most of the nebula. So it is also difficult to obtain something which is reliable. So the thing is that simply to account for the very inner part of the system. We have didn't this, the same kind of studies in 3D.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? On your last slide, you showed something on G21, some simulations.
Yes.
Can you elaborate?
Oh, this one.
Yeah.
Yes, these two. So.
So in terms of the X-ray emission maps,
yeah, the fact here is that, this is something to show that you cannot use 2D MHD to give some information on emission. And the reason is that, since the magnetic field is completely deformed from the fact that you are 2D, what you get is that the X-ray emission, in the case of G21.5, the emission is more or less the same at all the frequencies because the object is really, really young. So what you get is that if you consider the dynamical structure of the field, what you get is that, again, the emission is completely dominated by the fact that the field is wrong. So the best thing to do is simply to detach the dynamics of the field from the, well, from the complete evolution of the system. This is not reality, of course. But the idea is that you can simply trace the magnetic field by saying that it is, well, the magnetic pressure is connected to the total pressure of the system. So the simulation is evolving the total pressure. So you can say that a part of this pressure goes in magnetic field because it is what you expect in reality. And simply use this trick to trace the field. So what you get is that you cannot, in this case, you cannot reproduce the inner structure of the nebula because you have not the local structure of the field. But you are investigating something on, well, on a different view. So what you get is that more or less the complete dynamic of the system is the one of what you expect. So if you try to reproduce emission, you get that, in this case, for example, the field, well, the magnetic field is important because when you evolve it in the simulation, it accounts for the particle losses. So here you have still particle losses in these simulations. But the thing is that they are more uniform. So what you get is it is impossible to reproduce at all a jet total structure, for example, with this kind of simulations. But you can reproduce more or less, the, for example, the gamma ray emission, probably with this system, and also the low energy emission. Yeah. So here I have put this X-ray emission, but it's only a very particular
right.
case.
And there is a map of radio polarization, very old one that you should probably look at.
Yeah, but I didn't try to obtain polarization from this, but I want to.
Okay, all right, thank you, sir. Thank you so much. Okay, thank you. Is there one more? Oh, sorry, yeah, Eve, go ahead.
So you mentioned that in the simulations you have a difficulty to obtain magnetic field higher, as high as in observations, but I'm wondering if this statement is only for the crab, because the crab is, you've shown these very detailed models for the crab, but the crab is very
complicated because the inverse Compton is synchrotron-South Compton,
mm-hmm. and then you have to take into account with the spatial distribution of the photons and all this. Have you tried to do a similarly detailed comparison for other pulsar wave nebulae?
No, only for the case of Bauschok. So in the Bauschok, for example, we obtain a field which is more or less the one that you expect from the medium population that we know. But we are, well, for the moment, the 3D simulation of pulsar wave nebula is the only one, the only the crab.
Because so maybe it's the object to make a similar effort and a different young.
The problem is that since the simulation is so long, takes so long to run, the thing is that to try to optimize the number of things that you can try to reproduce, which is also something which is very difficult, you know.
All right. Thank you again, Barbara.
Thank you.